ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hey there, Sana Qadar here from All in the Mind. Check out our new series, Forensic. It's all about the psychological tools and tricks that come with investigating crime.
He was setting the bombs off in subways, in the New York Public Library, in movie theaters.
When you're testifying in court, rather than having purely your own memory, you take on all these little bits and pieces of information from different sources.
All in the Mind, Forensic. Search for All in the Mind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you're a victim of a crime and you need therapy to help you deal with a traumatic memory. Would you go ahead if it meant your case might not be prosecuted because the treatment could deem your evidence unreliable or inadmissible in court? Hi, Damien Carrick with you. This is The Law Report on ABC Radio National. The therapy in question is known as eye movement desensitization and regression, or EMDR. Around Australia, most prosecution guidelines don't specifically mention the treatment. In New South Wales, they do, as do Queensland's. But the Law Report can reveal that when a review is completed later this year, there will no longer be a specific provision relating to EMDR in Queensland's updated guidelines. Psychologists argue the legal system isn't keeping up with the science. Today we're asking, are the rules on EMDR therapy consistent across Australian jurisdictions? And what do we know about how they're applied? Dr. Katie Bird works in emergency medicine in Sydney. Katie was a complainant in a prosecution which was discontinued, she says, because she underwent EMDR.
I experienced it as a patient, and essentially what it looked like for me was recalling some of the traumatic memories that I'd sought psychological therapy for, and then going through a process of moving my eyes from one side to the next to help me process the feelings associated with those memories so that I was able to recall them without having the symptoms of PTSD that led me to reach out to this psychologist in the first time, and it was great. It really worked for me.
What does the therapist do, the psychologist do, while you are recalling those memories?
So we're sitting opposite each other. They're sitting in front of me and they're asking me to bring up in my mind or recall certain memories that hold certain emotions for me. And they might then just say, okay, notice what's coming up. And then after we do that, they move their finger from one side to the other side, and I follow along with my eyes. There are a couple of other ways that I was also doing it. So you can also tap with your hands on like your knees from one side to the other. I'm not exactly sure of the science behind it, but it helps to immediately lessen the strength of the emotions that are being recalled. It's a guided kind of process then after that of following that feeling or following that emotion wherever it then goes. And so it's not always that the memory is the thing that's in the front of mind. Sometimes it's more about how I'm feeling attached to that memory. And it's not that I explain to the psychologist any of the content of the memory or anything that is actually coming up for me. They just ask me to internally notice what is coming up before we do the processing.
And that also led you to think and talk about things that you had not thought about and talked about before. Is that right?
Yeah, before EMDR therapy, I wasn't able to speak to anyone about anything that happened to me, with particular to what I then was eventually able to speak to the police about and make a police report. So recalling the memories or trying to explain them to someone was giving me a lot of the symptoms of PTSD. And so I couldn't actually verbalize what had happened to me until I sought treatment for it, had the symptoms lessen, and then was able to realize also what happened to me wasn't okay and that I could go to the police and try and get a sense of legal justice through that process.
And can you just in general terms tell us what sort of events these were?
What I realised happened to me when I was a child was a form of sexual abuse.
So you went to the police. What happened at that point?
So I made the initial report back in 2021 to the police. And then there was a process of getting statements and going backwards and forwards for a few months. And they eventually referred me to the Commonwealth Department of Prosecutions. And they had laid the charges on the person. And then my communication became solely with the prosecutors at the CDPP. And then, unfortunately, in 2023, skipping forward a bit, the CDPP told me that there was no longer a reasonable prospect of conviction and discontinued the case.
Why?
So they explained to me in a video conference that they believed that EMDR had affected my ability to give testimony in the court, among a couple of other reasons. And I had appealed that process, which they'd informed me that I could do. And then I received a letter on the 23rd of May 2023 from the principal prosecutor involved in my case, confirming that the acting director at the time had reviewed after I had requested it, and they agreed with the initial decision to discontinue the case. One of the things that they quoted in that letter was that myself, as the witness for the Crown that was making the prosecution, having undergone EMDR therapy, was going to have a significant effect on the admissibility of the evidence I was able to provide. And so that was a large component of why the CDPP reached the opinion that prosecution couldn't continue at that time.
From the letter, I think it says, the particular nature of the circumstances of the charges in combination with the nature and circumstances of the EMDR therapy has resulted in the office reaching the view that the prosecution should be discontinued. What is your view of this review decision?
I was really upset.
Was there any evidence that the prosecution could use that came from before the EMDR? It sounds like you hadn't spoken to anyone before. There would be no records of you speaking to anyone before you'd had the EMDR. Is that right?
So there's one exception to that. I had actually sent messages to my boyfriend before I had undergone EMDR, and he was the only person that I had ever told about what happened to me. It was over Facebook message, and I submitted those messages to the police, and I presume then the prosecutors also saw them as well, and they spoke to the issues of what happened to me, not in a lot of detail, but certainly spoke about what had happened to me before EMDR therapy was ever part of it. But I hadn't spoken to anyone else. He was invited to give a statement basically that confirmed what I had told him and confirmed that he'd received those messages, which he also submitted to the police and was part of the evidence brief as well, as far as I'm aware.
But that doesn't seem to have changed the decision of the Commonwealth DPP to discontinue the prosecution.
It certainly doesn't, no.
And you would rather have been given your day in court to give evidence and perhaps be rigorously cross-examined by the defence about the EMDR and whether or not it was reliable evidence and whether or not it tainted or altered your memories?
Absolutely. I was ready to do that, and I was very prepared to be cross-examined and to have that process play out in court.
This is the Law Report on ABC Radio National. Today, looking at questions surrounding the admissibility and the reliability of evidence from complainants who have undergone EMDR therapy. Dr. Christopher Rudge is an expert in mental health law at the University of Sydney Law School. He says for many years now, courts and prosecutors have developed protocols for dealing with witnesses who have undergone hypnotherapy. Those protocols arose out of concerns that hypnotherapy puts patients into a trance-like state. that could make them susceptible to developing false memories or confabulations. Chris says those concerns led the law to superimpose the same tests on EMDR therapy.
Yes, it is a complex and case-by-case line from the early hypnosis cases to the EMDR cases. What happens is the early hypnosis cases, in addition to the risks of the reliability of the evidence, the lack of consistent protocols in the obtaining of hypnosis evidence is a problem for the courts. So the framework set down in the early cases is that if the courts were to admit hypnosis evidence, there needed to be disclosure of the source of the evidence, whether it's from hypnosis or some other process, to the courts. There needed to be a recording in some form of the evidence collection. There needed to be an independent practitioner, so this ruled out any police hypnotist, and there needed to be a warning to any jury. So the framework set up in the early cases was effectively adding admissibility rules to evidence of this nature. And those rules were laid down in those early cases until the New South Wales Court of Criminal Appeal in 1995 took the hypnosis rules and applied them to a case of EMDR.
Yeah, and that was the Tillett case. I think that was a case involving serious assaults on a prison guard by prisoners in the course of trying to escape. And one of the injured prison guards undergoes EMDR, and then there was a change in the way he described the event. So I think the judge in that case applied those protocols to whether or not you should accept EMDR evidence. Was there a pre-therapy statement? Were there recordings? Was there documentation showing the account predated the therapy? And other measures aimed at showing a person's account had not been improperly influenced. So that was the kind of principle of Tillett, right?
Indeed. So in Tillett, the session with the witness wasn't documented. There were no notes, no recording. And the witness's recollection, as you say, changed from the recollection before the EMDR session and afterwards. So the Court of Criminal Appeal held that the safeguards developed for hypnosis did apply to EMDR in that case. And EMDR was then only a six-year-old therapy. So it's not a great surprise that the New South Wales Court of Criminal Appeal at that time lumped them together. And the court itself called EMDR at that time novel and unexplained. So applying the hypnosis rules, but also indicating some doubt about the reliability of EMDR itself.
So it wasn't admissible in that case. Since then, though, there have been a number of other New South Wales cases which have expanded the space in which EMDR can be admissible.
Yeah, there were a number of cases that tested it. But another point worth noting is that the New South Wales Evidence Law, the Evidence Act, New South Wales Uniform Evidence Act, was enacted in 1995, which is the same year that Tillett was heard. It didn't apply to Tillett. But in cases after Tillett, it was the source of the rules for admissible evidence. And so in 2010, there was a case, New South Wales Director of Public Prosecutions and JG. And that case went to the New South Wales Court of Criminal Appeal. And it was in that case where the framework started to shift. The Court of Criminal Appeal held that the Tillett safeguards were no longer applicable because the evidence rules spoke over those common law safeguards, and a different test of probative value weighed against unfair prejudice and reliability was to be applied. And that test was a question for the jury or a judge alone, as opposed to a threshold question of admissibility. In other words, the evidence could be admitted, but its value was to be determined during the trial.
So the reliability of the evidence would be tested in the course of the trial, and the defence and the prosecution would have to convince the jury of their view of how reliable the evidence was.
That was the effective finding of the New South Wales Court of Criminal Appeal in that case of JG.
Okay, so we're talking about New South Wales, and presumably there'll be sort of other sort of case law journeys in other parts of the country, but the same sorts of principles would be applied. When it comes to prosecution guidelines, is EMDR mentioned in prosecution guidelines around the country?
prosecution guidelines are drafted in each state because we, of course, have criminal law operative in each state and territory and separate prosecution bodies. And we also have the Federal Criminal Code and the Director of Commonwealth Public Prosecutions. So there is a variety of guidelines. The clearest guideline, the most obvious guideline that speaks to EMDR is in New South Wales. And that guideline is a single sentence, and it effectively treats hypnosis and EMDR as the same thing, and says that evidence from a witness who has undergone either of those treatments cannot be used unless the director or a deputy director of the prosecution body personally approves it. So that's the framework that governs decisions about prosecuting a New South Wales state offence. And I think it is also relevant to Commonwealth prosecutions heard in New South Wales. However, the guidelines in other jurisdictions aren't so clear as that. But it appears there is a consistent position around the country.
With the permission of Dr. Katie Bird, I forwarded you a letter she received from the Commonwealth DPP outlining why a decision was made to discontinue the prosecution of which she was the complainant. What came to mind when you read that letter?
What I drew from that letter was that the Director of Public Prosecutions at the Commonwealth level was applying the same standards that would be applied in New South Wales vis-a-vis EMDR evidence. In other words, it was to be regarded with a degree of suspicion and a degree of forensic scrutiny based on its potential unreliability, either in substance or as a source of evidence that could lead to a successful prosecution.
And do you understand why the director would reach that conclusion?
I have a hypothesis, of course, because I have not been able to seek further information. But the hypothesis is simply that the equivalent of a New South Wales guideline is operative in the decision-making process, namely that a degree of scrutiny should be applied to EMDR evidence on the basis of those unreliability concerns.
Do you think that the prosecutors have the right approach? They're focusing on what they say is the admissibility of the evidence as opposed to the reliability of the evidence.
I think the approach whereby evidence derived from EMDR is consistent with evidence that was obtained before EMDR settles the matter in the sense that where the therapy comes after a complete statement and is used for symptom relief and the recollection hasn't changed, there is no concern relating to unreliability. And you also have the added benefit that the victim survivor has accessed a clinically validated therapy recommended in the guidelines for PTSD published by the NHMRC, and so is in a better state of mental health following that process and is not prejudiced for having undergone it.
And what about situations where it's less clear cut, where there hasn't been a sort of a police statement or a counsellor's notes or some other detailed account of the complainant prior to having the EMDR?
I think the proper approach, now that the Tillett authority is not operative, would be to allow the ordinary rules of evidence that permit admissibility as a default and allow the decision maker or the jury to weigh the probative versus prejudice effects of the evidence during the trial, run its course. And that would enable more particular considerations relating to its reliability to be determined during the prosecution rather than ex ante before any prosecution commences. Having said that, there may be cases where EMDR has been administered but the evidence is also unreliable in its own ways due to a lack of detail or something like that, which would give rise to an understandable decision by the prosecution body to not continue with the prosecution.
So it's a complex interplay of admissibility versus reliability.
Indeed, yeah. That's the heart of it.
Dr. Christopher Rudge from the University of Sydney Law School, who says the case law in New South Wales and everywhere else around the country supports the idea that all evidence is admissible and that questions of reliability can be determined at trial. But this doesn't mean prosecutors will always move forward to a trial. Psychologist Anthony Hurst is the chair of the EMDR Association of Australia. He says his organisation has been approached by a number of people around Australia whose cases, like Katie Bird's, have been discontinued. So does that mean psychologists need to warn patients that EMDR therapy could jeopardise a prosecution?
A lot of us are having conversations with clients, and you can appreciate that those conversations are very complex because, as Katie talks about, you know, it was raised by her therapist with her, and she said, there's no way I'd ever go to the police about this. I'm never going to talk to anyone about this. She got the therapy, then felt very differently, and then, of course, you experienced this. So the consenting even around that is very complex.
But I understand that she didn't even speak to her therapist about what the memories were.
Yeah, so one of the benefits of EMDR therapy, it's, you know, very much effective like a lot of other trauma therapies. But why some people lean toward it is because it doesn't require the same verbal elaboration. And so particularly children, adolescents, people where they don't feel comfortable, they feel shame, they feel all sorts of things, this therapy is quite helpful for them. And no, often they don't need to disclose very much about what's occurred to us.
Now, you're a psychologist, not a lawyer, but do you understand the need for prosecutors to only take on a case or only take a case to trial if there are strong prospects of success, and for courts to have rules around admissibility of evidence? You understand those concerns?
Yeah, I do understand those concerns. I guess part of my question is, in that assessment, the charge is likely to be upheld. I wonder how the DPP could accurately assess that if they're not confident on the latest literature and science, if they're not confident on what an expert witness could actually provide in that space. I just wonder how that assessment can be accurately and objectively made.
You're suggesting that the police and the prosecutors and perhaps even the courts are not quite up to speed with the science?
No, I don't think that they are, and I wouldn't expect them to be. You know, there are so many different things they've got to be looking at and thinking about.
So there is this concern in the legal system about EMDR. Why do you think courts and investigating officers and prosecutors and indeed defence lawyers, why do you think they distrust this trauma therapy?
Oh, look, when the therapy first came up in a case in Australia, there were a couple. There wasn't much known about EMDR therapy. There wasn't the 50 randomised controlled trials that we have today. There was a few studies that were around. And we didn't really understand as much about the mechanisms of it as we do now. And so in the context of that, my guess is you think, oh, there's eye movements happening, hypnosis has eye movements happening. There's a lot in the legal case law and literature about hypnosis. And it was, we don't know much about this, so we should treat them relatively similarly.
And what are the concerns about hypnosis?
Some of the concerns with hypnosis, as I spoke to you about how we say, okay, notice that, and it's quite scripted, right? So any EMDR therapist doing the standard protocol will say precisely that. Hypnosis is quite different because suggestibility is actually part of the mechanism. So part of it is suggesting things to help them see, think about things differently, to help them perhaps experience something different in relation to that. So the mechanism for hypnosis is very different. But also the way it was historically used is, even as a psychologist, I think quite unusual. So the history of it was that there was a particular version of it, forensic hypnosis, which wasn't, you know, someone using it for weight loss or to stop smoking. There were police officers who were using hypnosis with witnesses to try to get more information out of them about a perpetrator or to help them solve cases and address them. And so you can imagine where hypnosis, the part of what it does is suggestibility. And you've got potentially a police officer who maybe knows who the lead suspects are, you know, could find themselves asking questions like, do they have brown hair? Can you tell me this? The concerns regarding that were quite significant. And that was really where a lot of the rules around hypnosis came from.
And also the idea that maybe that in hypnosis you go into some kind of trance-like or different kind of consciousness.
Yes, which is specifically in that there's a heightened suggestibility of someone in the trance that they would do in hypnosis.
Okay, and you would ask us, as the chair of the board of the MDR Association of Australia, to look at the differences between these two therapies. Is EMDR specifically mentioned in state and territory or Commonwealth prosecution guidelines?
So it is mentioned in a couple of states, but we know that the conversation happens even when it's not explicitly mentioned. So there is a small comment in the New South Wales guidelines that for EMDR therapy to be used, it needs to be approved by the director. But Queensland DPP in particular have a quite extensive comment about EMDR therapy in there, and it incorrectly identifies it as a type of regression therapy and hypnosis.
Indeed, I think Guideline 27 is titled Hypnosis and Regression Therapy, so they're kind of lumped in together. Mm. Yep. And what about the Commonwealth? Katie Bird, the charges were dropped by the Commonwealth Director of Public Prosecutions. Does the Commonwealth Director of Public Prosecution guidelines have any mention of EMDR?
No, they don't. And so that's how we know that even when they're not explicitly mentioned, they're being spoken about.
Anthony Hurst, what do you want to see happen?
A number of things. One is I would first like for DPP prosecutors, even police, just to engage with the EMDR Association of Australia more. We can provide a lot of this information about what EMDR therapy is, because research has gone specifically to this, because we think that if we don't demonstrate, you know, reliability, accuracy in the research, this will probably just continue. And so published research has shown that there aren't differences in, you know, recall accuracy of information. So we want to be able to provide that to the DPP, to different players that are involved in this, so that they can have a more accurate and stronger understanding of what could be possible at trial if they bring in the right information.
Psychologist Anthony Hurst, chair of the EMDR Association of Australia. He spoke there about Queensland's prosecution guidelines, which are currently under review. The state's Office of the Director of Public Prosecutions has told the Law Report that when the review is completed later this year, there will no longer be a specific provision on EMDR or hypnosis in the updated guidelines. The statement goes on to say that, consistent with other Australian jurisdictions, cases with evidence obtained through EMDR are assessed appropriately by the Office of the Director of Public Prosecutions with reference to expert evidence. That's all we've got time for this week. Do follow the Law Report on ABC Listen. That way you'll get the latest podcast as soon as it becomes available. And a big thank you to producer Christina Kukolia and also to audio producer Elise Simons. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk soon.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.